next case is case number 52557, Welday versus Summerlin Life and Health Insurance Company. We have Mr. Prince for the appellant, Mr. Bice for the respondent, and probably two very happy clients that the billing will be much shorter than it would be had you had to come to Carson City last night and rented a car and come down to visit us. So we hope that you'll let your clients know that this is an accommodation that we felt was essential for the bar in Clark County. Mr. Prince, for the appellant.
Justice Chair, thank you, and good morning to the panel, if it pleases the court. The make-whole doctrine is a very sound expression of the public policy in the state of Nevada, because it balances the interests of the expectations of both the insured and the insurer. And this case really underscores the soundness of that policy. As it stands right now, Mr. Welday, because he elected to pursue a third-party claim against the tortfeasor who severely injured him, he owes his health insurer $90,000 and has a judgment entered against him. His net recovery was only $60,000. He owes more than $30,000 of the amount that he is going to recover from the net proceeds. And that really underscores why the make-whole doctrine is an sound expression of the public policy in the state of Nevada. The Maxwell case, this court has already decided that an insurer may not subrogate against its own insurer in a first-party context where that insurer has not been made whole. And the reason that the court gave was the concern that the insurer has not been fully compensated because of their injuries. And it's because of that expression of the public policy that you should apply the make-whole doctrine here and not as a default provision. If you look at the cases that you decided after, the Maxwell case, Sullivan, you again refused to allow a set-off provision for a medical payments coverage in a context of an underinsured motorist claim because the insured had not been fully compensated. This principle was again underscored in CSA versus Ellison, where the court did allow the offset provision because in that case the insured had been fully compensated. So it always has depended upon whether the insured has been fully compensated. Here, Mr. Welday's tortfeasor recovery was $100,000 before attorney's fees and costs, and his medical expenses exceeded that amount. So he has not been fully compensated. That did not even include any amount for pain and suffering. Now,
how about the policy in this case, Mr. Prince? Do we need to look at the language of the policy?
Under Maxwell, no. No, I don't think you need to do that. I think it has already been expressed as the public policy of this state that we're not going to enforce subrogation clauses, irrespective of what the language contains, if the insured has not been fully compensated. And that's the overriding criteria in my mind based upon my review of the cases that you had before. And even that's consistent with Canfora. The court elected not at that point when deciding Canfora to decide whether the make-whole doctrine applies in a situation in a health insurance context where the insured has not been fully compensated.
So you say that our body of law clearly says that you can't write around this public policy and that we have reaffirmed that over and over again in the line of cases.
I believe in the line of cases you have, that's correct. I think you left open the question as to how you're going to treat a health insurance situation. But for congruency, I think you need to treat both cases the same. Medical payments coverage under an automobile policy operates much the same way as a health insurance policy. It applies irrespective of fault. Unlike underinsured motorist coverage, it's fault-based coverage. Medical payments coverage, they have to pay whether the driver or the insured is at fault or not, if you're a passenger or you're an operator, much the same way that the health insurance operates. Now, even if you look at that, the language of this particular policy clearly does not have this, is not in a clear expression, it's not unequivocal that the insured, in this case Mr. Welday, is waiving the make whole doctrine. In all of the case, even using a default type of analysis, all turn upon the language that the insured is waving around the make whole doctrine. Here, the policy is ambiguous. Section C1 of the policy says that the Summerlin is subrogated to all rights of recovery. Well, trying to use the broadest, most expansive term possible is what makes it ambiguous, because it doesn't tell you at what point they get to start to recover. All it says is we're subrogated to all rights of recovery. The cases we've cited to you, both the Yolo case, the Chong case, clearly indicate that that type of language, even though it's expansive, is not specific enough to wave around the make whole doctrine. And if you look in then at section C3, which is where the district court judge Levitt, she focused her attention, is on the first priority language. Now, the first priority language creates even more ambiguity, because what it does, it doesn't tell you at what point you have first priority. And priority typically deals with priority among other claimants. And so if you naturally construe these two clauses together, they must have something mean something different because they're not contained in the same section of the policy. Here, Ms. Welday grants them a first priority of recovery, which would relate to if there was other claimants outstanding, that they could, the insurer could rely upon that language of the policy in order to defend itself against other claimants competing for the same reimbursement issues. Now, you don't even need to go farther than that. If you don't think that's ambiguous on its face, if you look at the lien and agreement that was sent to Mr. Welday, it specifically says, I will reimburse the plan as first priority, even if I believe I was not fully compensated for my loss. If that's truly what they wanted to do in the plan document, they should have put that language in. And every case that we've cited to you is with this same issue, applying a default type of make-whole doctrine, has only upheld it where the language has been, if the insured was, regardless of whether you're made whole, if you're not made whole, regardless of whether you're fully compensated. And one of the cases, Justice Sada?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt with that by making that puzzling look on my face so obvious. So you're really saying that the district court order not only applied the wrong section of the insurance agreement, but also in her own language where she finds as a result of the express exclusions of the make-whole doctrine that she was just plain wrong. That's just not there. Fair statement?
That's correct.
And therefore, even if there is a question about it, the motion for summary judgment was far premature. Fair statement?
Definitely. Yeah. Now, one of the cases that this court cited in the Canfora case was the Cagle case. It's an 11th Circuit case. And in that case, they found the plan, even an ERISA plan, its language was insufficient to wave around the make-whole doctrine. And the reason why it was insufficient is because it didn't include the necessary predicate language that the make-whole doctrine didn't apply and that their right of recovery was regardless of whether the insured was made whole. That's the type of language. Now, the lien agreement is interesting because it was required to be signed by Mr. Welday, and it constitutes an impermissible modification of the plan without any consideration. If you look at the plan documents, they do not preserve or wave around the make-whole doctrine. It's only in the lien agreement that Mr. Welday, he finally signs because he has to in order to get his benefits, that Summerlin has now has an agreement from its insured, impermissibly in my opinion, that they're going to have to reimburse Summerlin no matter whether he's fully compensated or not. And this does not operate as a prejudice to Summerlin because probably in most cases the insured is going to be fully compensated. It's only in the rare instance when the insured is not fully compensated. And this interpretation is also consistent with what a reasonable expectation of its insured is. He's already paid for the coverage. And now he's having to give money. Even though he's paid for the coverage, he has to give part of that money back. Let's say, for example, Mr. Welday elected not to pursue a third-party claim just because he's not litigious and did not want to pursue a claim. They would still have to pay out the benefits, and Mr. Welday would owe no money back. And that really identifies the fallacy of this whole provision. This is a very important case in the context of someone who has not been fully compensated for their injuries. Because as right now, Mr. Welday, he owes $30,000 more than he's actually recovered to Summerlin. That's probably the most unequitable result I've ever seen. And I don't think that's consistent with this court's expression of the policy in the state of Nevada in the Maxwell, the Sullivan, or even the Canfora case. Now, with respect to the lien agreement, it's clear that document was an attempted modification of the policy. It didn't follow the terms and conditions of the policy, but Summerlin mandated that Mr. Welday sign that as a condition of him getting his benefits. And it's that very agreement that that language should have been put in the policy in the first place had Summerlin so elected. This is a contract of adhesion. They are in full control of the language that they employ and they utilize in these plan documents. These are very sophisticated agreements. They contain a lot of technical terms, and if they truly want their insurer to wave around the make-whole doctrine, they should have included it in very sufficient and very clear language. The modern trend of cases is to have this regardless language, this alternative language that the insurer is going to be reimbursed regardless of whether the insured is made whole, regardless of whether the insured is fully compensated. An additional 5 or 6 words probably clarifies that position. I don't believe you even need to reach that issue because I believe it's considered this provision, even assuming it is a valid waiver around the make-whole doctrine, it violates Nevada's public policy. That's a threshold issue for this court to determine. Because if you affirm the district court's judgment, now Mr. Welday's got to come out of pocket an additional $30,000, money he did not get, simply because he utilized his health insurance and made a third-party claim. That's a very inequitable result. The entire concept of the make-whole doctrine, it's an equitable doctrine. And I think if you construing the language and the doctrine in the way that Summerlin has done it, it would lead to a very inequitable result. If the court is inclined to follow that, I think the recovery should be limited at a minimum to the net recovery of Mr. Welday. But more importantly, they're not entitled to recover any first-party proceeds because Mr. Welday also recovered $25,000 from Progressive. The policy speaks in terms of recovery from a third party. There is nothing contained in the plan documents or even the attempted modification of the lien and agreement which speaks to a recovery from a first-party insurer that Mr. Welday elected to protect himself through other available insurance. And so, therefore, they don't have any lien on, at all on those proceeds.
Mr. Prince, would you say that when Judge Leavitt ruled on this is a 100% legal issue to resolve, so there's no facts here for either side here that we need to get into?
No, I don't believe that.
Okay.
I agree there's no genuine issue of material fact. Unless the court has any additional questions, I'll reserve my final 3 minutes.
Any further questions? Just give me just
no.
You have about 3 minutes and 14 seconds left. Mr. Bice, on behalf of the respondent.
May it please the court, Todd Bice on behalf of Summerlin Life. Good morning, Your Honors. This court in the Canfora decision did articulate its recognition of the made whole doctrine, and in specifically referencing the fact that the parties can contractually modify that doctrine. It is a gap filler. It is, as this court said in Canfora, it is a term that is implied in the contract when the parties have not addressed what will happen under those circumstances. Now we turn to the question of, well, here we have a litigant that claims they did not recover, they were not made whole. So how does the contract operate? So I disagree with the assertion that you don't have to look at the contractual language under Canfora. That's exactly what you have to look to, is the contractual language. And let's remember what we're talking about here. We're talking about implying something into the contract. All right? That's what we're talking about. Well, what has this court long held for a long time? When you imply a term in the contract, that's fine, but it can't contradict an actual existing term that is already in the contract if you're going to imply one. And look at what happens in this circumstance if you buy the argument here that the made whole doctrine should trump this contractual language. Set aside the lien language for just a moment, but let's just look at the plan language in and of itself and ask yourself this question. Does that language operate if, in fact, the made whole doctrine is applied, as Mr. Welday is arguing to this court? Does the first priority language operate? And the answer is no, it's rendered a nullity. What is a first priority? There are two words in there, first and priority. First means number one. I get paid first. That's the insurance company. That's what first priority means. I get paid first. Out of any recovery, and I'll get to this point about the UM coverage because they're just misquoting what the policy actually says, but first priority means I get paid first. Who is first? The insurance company is first. Who comes after first? Mr. Welday and everybody else. If you buy the argument that they are making that the made whole doctrine trumps this first priority language, then the first priority language is rendered, it's been neutered. It has no meaning. Because when else would it apply? And that's the problem with their argument. They're asking you to imply a term in equity into a contract that contradicts the express terms. Now, I recognize that there are several cases, primarily the Sixth Circuit has bought this argument. But I would submit to this court that that is a result of convenience rather than one of conviction based on analysis. Because the court there simply said, well, you have to essentially have the magic words. You have to have the words that essentially say, regardless, just as Mr. Prince argued, regardless of whether or not the plaintiff recovers is made whole or not. That's what the Sixth Circuit said you basically have to have in order to constitute a waiver. But you'll notice the Sixth Circuit in no way addressed what that first priority language would mean outside of that context.
But isn't it just a good public policy for us to be mindful of the fact that individuals throughout the country pay, or at least are entitled to, certain coverage that then gets essentially taken away under your construction, that they really don't get what they've contracted for?
I disagree with that, Justice Sotomayor. I do think they get what they contracted for, because when you're talking about health insurance, what you're contracting for is you're contracting that regardless of whether somebody else is at fault or regardless of whether you just have bad luck, bad genes, whatever, you get coverage. They're going to pay it. The risk, and part of that risk equation is the express agreement, though, that if somebody else causes your injuries, and that you have a claim against them for those injuries, and I, as the insurer, have paid for those benefits, the express bargain is, then I, as the insurer, get that money back. The risk, I have not assumed that risk. The risk I assumed as the insurer was, you get sick, you get injured due to no fault of anybody else, and therefore I'm on the hook 100% for that coverage. But the agreement, the express agreement is, if somebody else causes your harm, and somebody else is responsible for it, then I get reimbursed. That's the agreement that we struck. Now, the point here is, again, I ask the court, what does the first priority language even mean if it doesn't mean first and priority? Mr. Welby's argument is he has first priority. Strip away all the rhetoric of their position, and that's exactly what they're contending is. That first priority language for Summerlin Life means nothing, because Mr. Welday has first priority. Their argument is he first gets made whole, and then anything above and beyond that, he has to give to you. And the courts have recognized, I acknowledge, and I've said, the Sixth Circuit, I think, has just plain got it wrong when it takes the position that the word first priority isn't enough, because it couldn't explain how those words would ever be operative in a contract if they weren't enough. But then we come to the next point is, and that's the lien. Justices, we have the lien language here that it even contains the magic words that they say needed to exist in order to constitute a waiver of the made whole doctrine. But they have a response, and their response is, well, that document's invalid. Look at the record below. This is summary judgment. They are contending, essentially, that that document is void, I guess, lack of consideration, duress. I have never really heard the clear articulation of how it is void. But when you are claiming that a document is void, you have the burden of proof. You must plead the defect in the document, whether it's lack of consideration, duress, whatever you're going to argue under Rule 8. Rule 8 spells all that out, and you have to plead it and you have to prove it. They didn't even file an answer in this case asserting any of those defenses. In response to our counterclaim, they merely filed a motion for summary judgment, which does not raise any of these issues. It did not contend in the slightest that that document was void. This was their burden of proof at the court below. The district court did correctly enter summary judgment because the party claiming that that document is inoperative presented no evidence whatsoever to establish that it was inoperative. It never pled the defect in that document, and it never presented any competent evidence to prove any purported defect in that document. And when you look at that document, they acknowledge it contains the magic words. There's no question about that document. If that document is operative, this argument that they want to make about the made whole doctrine fails. On its face, it fails. under all of the case law that they cite. So our point here is there is nothing, in, when you took a look at the record in this case, this is summary judgment that was entered in this case. Both parties filed cross motions for summary judgment. They've acknowledged in front of you there are no material issues of fact. Well, they are the party that would bear the burden of proof in terms of attacking that lien document that their client signed. Having failed to do so, there can be no argument that that document is void, especially up on appeal, which wasn't even raised in their motion. If you look at what their motion for summary judgment, it was in their reply brief in response to our motion, where they add essentially, I think it may be one, maybe two sentences about a lack of consideration. That's the extent of it. No affidavit from anyone presenting a material issue of fact, nothing of the sort. And that's why that document is fully valid and enforceable, justices. And you go back and look at this point. He signed that document. This is that excerpt of record, our excerpt of record at page 8. He signed that document on February 24th of 07. Then, if you look at excerpt of record page 9 of our excerpt, Sumner Life sent a letter to his counsel, Mr. Prince, specifically noting the fact of the lien. And in response to that, excerpt of record page 12, Mr. Prince's firm responds saying, our firm will gladly sign a lease for purposes of subrogation reimbursement to your company. There was no ambiguity here. He had already signed and acknowledged in the lien agreement what the scope of the subrogation rights were. And that, as it specifically says, as counsel acknowledges, it says regardless of whether you are made whole or not. So they are right on this point. There is no material issue of fact here. The documents specifically provide, I would submit, just to say that even under the plan itself, setting aside the lien document, under the plan itself, that first priority word has to be given meaning. And if it is, that then is an express contractual arrangement around the made whole doctrine. But if there was some ambiguity about it, which I dispute, but if there was, the lien document makes that clear, and they have presented no competent evidence to mount an attack on that document. They didn't even present that defense below. Now let me turn to, if I might, the issue about Mr. Prince had made the argument, well, what if we hadn't even sued a third party? This is a windfall to someone in life, he argues, because what if we had? Well, the contract speaks to that. The insurance policy speaks to that. In conditions, part 10, it specifically says he has to cooperate and we would have the right to pursue those third parties in the event he was refusing to do so to seek reimbursement. The fact that he chose to pursue them doesn't somehow negate our subrogation rights. And then he says, also, we aren't entitled to their UM coverage. Well, look again, look at the express terms of the contract. It doesn't limit it to third-party recovery. That's the case that they cite, by the way, I believe it's out of Wisconsin. The court there said, well, that the contract, the subrogation rights by its express terms were limited to third parties who caused the injury. Well, our subrogation rights are expressly set forth, and this is at our excerpt of record at page 6, which are part 10, the conditions. And it expressly says that we are entitled to first priority lien holder from any recovery, settlement, or judgment, parenthesis, or other source of compensation, in parenthesis, the amounts due in the claim, parenthesis, regardless of whether this lien was specifically set forth in the recovery, settlement, judgment, or compensation agreement. Again, it's not limited to their direct recovery against third parties. He specifically contractually agreed that in the event he obtained any compensation for his injuries, he would repay the medical expenses to the extent we paid for his coverage. And we did that. And there's no dispute that we paid $90,000+ in medical expenses on his behalf. And we paid those regardless of whether he ever recovered another dime from somebody else. But his agreement was, if I do recover a dime from somebody else, I will make sure that first priority health insurance company, you get repaid. And that's all we're saying.
It's been a while since I've done a PI case as a lawyer, but does Summerlin negotiate what they get, like other liens? I mean, is that the policy of Summerlin, or do they just take it all?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what precisely you're asking me. In other words, had had they been contacted by counsel? I mean, if you look at their letter to Mr. Prince, it specifically, I believe, no, I take that back. In the bottom, in the body of the lien itself, Your Honor, it specifically says that they would obtain, you know, I understand that the reimbursement will not be reduced to reflect any costs or attorney's fees incurred in obtaining compensation unless separately agreed to in writing by the plan administrator in the exercise of its sole discretion.
So they can do it.
They can do it if they had been asked to do so. Right, and had, I mean, had there ever been a negotiation about it. The plan, the lien specifically references that fact. But I don't believe, and I'll just have to defer to the record on this, I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that they contacted the Summerlin Life in an attempt to negotiate what that amount should be. But yes, they had the document he signed specifically references that that was a possibility.
That
it
answers
was,
my question.
It was never pursued. And I, although I have a minute, 50 seconds left, I...
Justice Gibbons, just say to any further questions from...
I feel I've taken enough of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bice. Mr. Prince, your rebuttal?
Thank you.
You have 3 minutes and 14 seconds.
Mr. Prince, what effect does it have when you acknowledge the lien, you know, the attorney's lien, which you did properly, you know, the normal procedure it's done here, is that Mr. Bice has made a point of that on top of everything else. Does that kind of consummate the contract there and reinforce it by your acknowledgement?
No, I think it just is acknowledging the subrogation interest of Summerlin and that you're going to honor the terms of the plan as it may relate to subrogation. Realizing by February 24, 2007, that was shortly after the accident, the full nature and extent of Mr. Welday's injuries were not fully known at that point. But more importantly, what we could recover from the tortfeasor wasn't fully known. So that was a form-driven document that was sent out by Summerlin. I'm assuming customarily it's common for many health insurers to do send out either some kind of a written acknowledgement or to send you a letter. But the import of this particular lien is interesting because if Mr. Bice, as he professes, that the first priority language is so clear, why did they add in the lien document, which they don't have in the plan, that I will reimburse the plan as first priority even if I believe I was not fully compensated? That language is not contained in the plan documents. As Mr. Bice argues, if the plan is so clear, then why didn't they include regardless of whether I'm fully compensated or even if I believe I was not fully compensated? That's significant. This is an attempted modification of the plan document for a particular individual. This is part of a group plan. And they were trying to impermissibly modify the plan without prior consideration or approval from the Department of Insurance because this is not what's agreed in the plan document. Now, with respect to this, the regardless language, I'm going to call it the regardless language, which you, when you're indicating in the plan document that you're contracting around. Even in the Barnes case, that's the Ninth Circuit case we cited, that was one of the deficiencies with respect to that language. It doesn't matter if you say any or all right to recover, you call it first priority, unless you have the additional language which would put an insured on notice that, hey, I'm going to have to reimburse you irrespective of whether or not I'm fully compensated. Because that'll do a few things in the personal injury arena. It'll cause you to either go negotiate with your health insurer. It may cause you to hold out for some additional settlement because you may have a liability dispute. I mean, it may shape a lot of different activities by the lawyer and on behalf of a personal injury claimant who is being reimbursed through health insurance. Now, the problem with the first priority language is first priority between whom? And when do we start to determine the priority? The argument is from dollar one, but who are we determining between dollar one with who? Are we talking about between Summerlin and Mr. Welder? Are we talking about Summerlin and third-party claimants? Because they want to use that language both ways. If there are other people, third-party claimants, seeking the same type of reimbursement out of a pool of settlement funds, they're also going to rely on that language and use it against them, not just against Mr. Welder. They're trying to use it as an all-encompassing grant of a first priority lien over anyone, including Mr. Welday. But the document is simply not clear enough, which would put Mr. Welday or any other covered person on notice of that. And this court did not determine in Canfora that this is a gap filler term, that actually it did apply the make-whole doctrine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Panel, thanks both counsel. Argument was excellent, as I expected from both of you. I've known you both for a long time. And this case will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess at 11:30.